This is kind of a continuation of the session that was begun yesterday, but if you missed yesterday's session, you don't have to worry about it, because I think the stuff today will sort of stand on its own legs as well. I'll summarize quickly what we talked about yesterday, especially the emphasis. The topic today is personal power or personal empowerment in nuclear age. And most of what I've been doing has been based on Joanna Macy's book called Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age. And the primary emphasis yesterday was on the despair part. And in fact, some people I think were pretty disappointed. It was a way of guaranteeing that people might come back today, because if you're looking for personal empowerment, the despair is only the first part. But Joanna Macy is saying that the despair part is an important part, and it's very hard to immediately try and sort of grab on to power, or if you do, the kind of power you're grabbing onto is probably not the kind you want anyway. From the perspective that she's offering in the book and sort of the theoretical framework that she's developing her technique from, working through a sense of pain and grief corporately is a very important aspect of recognizing the special kind of power that we're going to be in search of. It's not just a matter of more political power or a matter of having power over situations or over people, but it's a matter of working with a kind of power that emerges from the recognizing the interactions that we have with other people and with the kinds of systemic forces that are going on in the world. And so today we're going to talk a little bit more about what is the nature of that power that might emerge. Before I do that, I'd like to read kind of a summary section with regard to the despair part we talked about yesterday. There's a couple paragraphs that I didn't get to read yesterday that to me are kind of central in the whole idea of why it's an important process to recognize and, in a sense, suffer with the world. There'll be time, let me interrupt that little introduction. There'll be time today, I'm sure, there better be, to have some sharing amongst all of us with regard to the techniques and times of empowerment that you felt and ways that you feel might be helpful for sharing with other people in the group. That's part of why I'm doing this, because I want to hear what sources of inspirations of power the rest of you have found as well.
On my way up here, I was driving over from Seattle, Washington to the Tri-City area, which is a few hundred miles from here, and then from there I left and came from there to here. And on my way, I had my car radio turned off, and I was given some instruction, it's a three part adventure, three part mystery. First, I needed to surrender. Then the empowerment would come. Then the vision or the mission. And that's all that was given to me. And then I think the fourth thing that kind of that I'm hanging myself on is trust, because I don't know what a plan, you know, I just go moment by moment. And that's the marvel of it all. I trust it because I want to keep it. And if I give it away, I'll keep it. If I don't trust it, I'll lose it.
It's a good process. Hope it works for you. I hope you find yourself able to go through that here. How long are you be here?
I'm leaving.
You're leaving? Oh, already? This weekend?
Today.
Today.
How's it going?
Fantastic.
Okay, good.
To experience pain as we register what is happening to our world is a measure of our evolution as open systems. This is not only true from the perspective of systems science, but from of religion as well. How many mystics in their spiritual journey have spoken of the dark night of the soul? Brave enough to let go, there's that concept you just referred to, brave enough to let go of accustomed assurances, they let their old convictions and conformities dissolve into nothingness and stood naked to the terror of the unknown. They let processes which their minds could not encompass work through them. Hello, darkness, my old friend. It is in that darkness that birth takes place. Many religious people are reluctant to acknowledge their feelings of despair, lest their faith be shaken or appear to falter. Yet the very state of facing the unknown, bereft of assurance, has always been recognized by traditional paths as sacred. It is there, says Jacob Needleman, in that fleeting state between dreams, which is called despair in some Western teachings, and self-questioning in the Eastern traditions, that a person is said to be able to receive the truth, both about nature and about one's own possible role in that universal order. Jews have known this as the dry, bone-rattling bleakness of exile, and so have Christians in the darkness of Good Friday and the terror-filled mystery of the cross, where Jesus himself, experiencing the agony of the world in his own flesh, cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so it is, too, with the Bodhisattva, the hero model in the Buddhist tradition, who can hear the music of the spheres and understand the languages of the birds, but by the same sensitivity to the web of life, he or she also hears the cries of torment from the deepest levels of hell. All is registered in the boundless heart of the Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva. Through our deepest and innermost responses to the world, to hunger, to torture, to the threat of annihilation, we touch that boundless heart. It is the web we have woven as interconnected systems, or as synapses in the mind of God. To put it in more familiar terms, I'll read a letter from a woman in Minnesota. I believe in a God who is grieving deeply for his or her people, who is calling us, pleading with us to enter into that same grief. My faithfulness to this God has helped me to keep true to my grief for the world. But if it ended in grief, if Good Friday was the end of the story, it would be a pretty sad story. And I'm not sure it'd be worth the worth the price. But Joanna Macy claims that out of that despair and grief comes something. Let's talk about what comes, what hopefully can come. I'm just going to read substantial portions of this. I guess partly that's a confession of my own the process or the state that I'm in right now of just trying to incorporate this myself. I've given a lot of thought to this before. I've come to a lot of the same conclusions she has, but I'm not able to express it any better than she can. I might stop from time to time and comment, or I welcome you to stop me. I'll try to allow breaks for commentary. But there's just certain things about her writing style and the poetry, the poetic way she has of expressing things that I delight in, and I want to share some of that with you. She talks about power as process. As our pain for the world is rooted in our interconnectedness with all life, there's that theme coming back again, so surely is our power. But the kind of power at work in that web of life, in and through open systems, is quite different from our customary notions of power. The old concept of power, in which most of us have been socialized, originated in a particular worldview. This view, as we noted, saw reality as composed of discrete and separate entities, be they rocks, plants, atoms, people. Whether you were Aristotle classifying these entities into categories, or whether you were Galileo or Newton studying their vectors and their velocities, this was the context in which you worked. And power, thereby, came to be seen as a property of these separate entities, reflected in the way that they could appear to push each other around. It became identified with domination. Look it up in the dictionary. More often than not, it is still defined as having your way with other people. In other words, it is seen as power over. This for me is really rings true in the Newtonian concept of power. It has to do a great deal with the ability to effect another body, another object. There's these bodies and they do things, they bump into each other, there's forces being exchanged between them. And yet there's a different, more subtle aspect to power, which you can, if you're clever, you can see in Newtonian physics as well, but it's more clear in the modern physics, and it's more clear, as she points out, in the newer understandings. In the old view of power, power is a zero-sum game. The more you have, the less I have. If you win, I lose. It fosters the notion, furthermore, that power involves invulnerability. To be strong, to keep from being pushed around, defenses are needed. Armor and rigidity are needed, so as not to let oneself be influenced or changed. Power is to set up walls, to increase the separateness, the disconnectedness, to be able to defend yourself. And then, from that invulnerable position, to be able to exert influence. From a systems perspective, however, this patriarchal notion of power is both inaccurate and dysfunctional. Life processes are intrinsically self-organizing and evolve through the dynamic and symbiotic interaction of open systems. Power, then, which is the ability to effect change, works not from the top down, but from the bottom up. It is not power over, but power with. It is what the system scientists call synergy. That word synergy has been around for a while. I don't know if it's familiar to all of you. It kind of came up, I started hearing about it probably back in the 60s or something, and I'm not sure who it has coined it. Maybe it was Bucky Fuller or somebody, but sin together and ergy the energy. So it's a togetherness energy. And it was used to describe that specific kind of behavior that arises not from each individual part, but from the parts working together. You get a cooperative power. There are just certain functions that won't occur without the cooperative interaction of all the parts of the system. So, life systems evolve flexibility and intelligence, not by closing themselves off from the environment and erecting walls of defense, but by opening ever wider to the currents of matter, energy, and information that flow amongst them. It is in this interaction that life systems grow, integrating and differentiating. Here, power, far from being identified with invulnerability, requires just the opposite: openness, vulnerability, readiness to change. This is indeed the direction of evolution. As life forms evolve in intelligence, they shed their armor. They reach outward to an ever wider interplay with the environment. They grow sensitive, vulnerable protuberances, eyes and ears, noses, eyeballs, lips, tongues, fingertips, the better to feel and respond, the better to connect in the web and weave it further. I mean, the human animal is incredibly vulnerable in the way we're put together. The power of open systems, then, is not a property that one can own, but a process that one opens to. It arises in interaction as systems, be they people or plants or molecules, engage and enhance their own and each other's capabilities. Efficacy is transactional. efficacy, effectiveness is transactional, occurs in the interplay. What does that do for you? Is that that says a lot to me, but if you can't put that into concrete terms, it's just abstraction and it doesn't do anything. Does that grab you at all? Do any of you feel, when you look into your own life and you say, what are the times that I've felt power? What are the times I've recognized power in my life? Can you think of any times when it's had any aspect of this kind of quality that she's talking about?
Well, power generally as a bottom-up image or concept runs counter to the way that most of our lives are assaulted by the systems that are around us, which are generally hierarchical, the ladder concept of getting to the top and therefore having power.
Right. That's where the power is, we say. And that's why we say we feel powerless. Because we experience an inability to affect that top. And so we say, here I am down here. If I were at the top of the pyramid, aha, then what I could do. But down here at the bottom of the pyramid, what can I do?
But synergy is more the concept of a circle where we can hold hands and interdependent basis, do some things that you couldn't do alone. And therefore achieve some efficacy, some effect, some power.
I think in my most hopeful moments, I can go along with that, and there's probably been some examples in my life where I've thought that's correct, and when I've given assent to it. I don't know that I trust that, that picture of the world that you just, I think it's nice. Wouldn't it be nice if the world worked that way? But I really don't believe it. So. And I think we kind of get caught between those two notions of power. And I think a lot of people's experience in the world is that, we'd like to give assent to that, and yet we're pretty scared that if we do, we won't survive. That it won't work.
And the only response I can have to that, I guess, is that the other power doesn't work either. I guess it's really clear to me, and that's why I rely on something like this, that the limits of, that the exercise of the other kind of power is exactly what's led to arms races and nuclear, the threat of nuclear holocaust, and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I so strongly feel the need to disown that kind of power that this seems to be the only kind of power left to me.
How do you survive, though, when you're operating out of that particular model and you're surrounded by a culture that's operating out of the other kind of model?
I'm not
sure.
That's the question I
bring here.
Yeah.
First 500 years are going to be tough.
That's right.
That's what I can just hear the disciples saying in the first century, in the early church, saying, look at us, look at this little minority, this little tiny group, 12 people to start with, and a few hundred maybe all together that we can count amongst our friends, and how are we going to survive in the face of this world that doesn't understand at all what we're talking about? Not even our Jewish friends understand what we're talking about.
Well, you're right at it. We operate out of the Old Testament, where we smite the other cheek type thing, whereas the New Testament we're told to offer the other cheek. The whole Matthew Sermon on the Mount is being nonviolent. The kingdom is what you're talking about, as opposed to fighting the kingdom as we're doing in resisting it. I mean, we're supposed to be suffering. We're not supposed to be on top of it all, as I see it.
So that for me, there's a sense in which there's nothing new here.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Why it's comfortable, and yet it's still challenging, because it's a call back, it's a reminder of a message that's too easy to forget.
But we'll be destroyed, we're communists or whatever we are for thoughts.
One of the dangers is complacency. And the idea, not the idea, but the whole mystery and the wonder, that the power and the glory and the honor are all His, and they're in earthen vessels as we are. You kind of sometimes tend to get complacent about that. I do sometimes.
I can, but I guess that's why the image of God as both transcendent, His and male, and at the same time sort of imminent and in the earth and in these processes and of a more female quality is real helpful for me to see that it's not just power out there somewhere that we have to sit back and complacently hope somehow comes and redeems us, but that power is given in and through us, and the processes that we're experiencing together are manifestations of God. I mean, God is in that. God is that synergy. I mean, that's almost blasphemous, but I mean to say that God is, but God is in that synergy. At least I can say that, and to and can use that. So can Satan. So can Satan. I mean, the forces of evil can use these synergic types of concepts and forces as well. But let's choose sides and go for it. Yeah.
Just to respond to the question of how do we live in this sort of two worlds, because of the way they are, two worlds from a point of view. One thing that's certainly been helpful to me is to take advantage of the situation where you're not sort of taking everything on at once. To sort of experiment with it and try it out, find out where it gets you astray. And the building of trust in working that way, it seems to me, is part of the process of being able to where you can, each step is not so huge if you don't take everything on at once. And every time something has worked, it kind of builds your confidence to try it in another situation.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that changes my sense of what the reality really is.
That really rings true for me. There's a book that just came out last year, I think a couple of years ago, called Up From Apathy. I don't know if any of you heard that or read that, but a fellow down in Texas did a study of activists in this country, interviewing a number of them. There were, about 80 or 90 in his sample. Interviewed a number of people and then added to that the literature from certain people that are sort of recognized as activists, like Martin Luther King or Gandhi or somebody. He put that into his mix. And he said, what kind of characteristics do they have? What's in their background? What kind of experiences have they had that propel them from the point of just either sitting back in defeat or complacency or despair, or maybe having consciousness but not being able to implement that in any kind of action? What makes an activist? And one of the very common things there was the sense of starting small and just realizing that just getting that reinforcement of some small recognition that the process can work, or that I can make a difference, and realizing that in the small scale then gives a little bit of more confidence and courage to go on and do a little bit more. It doesn't just sort of, or very rarely does it come kind of out of the blue that you take on the whole world and succeed. Although it did in that film, right, that somebody was telling you about yesterday. Jimmy Stewart can do it.
I had an experience with personal and synergistic power a few years back when I was living in Wisconsin. And I went to an area of Wisconsin to help some farmers try to stop a freeway that was going to go across their land. It was totally unnecessary to build this freeway, but nonetheless, it was going to be built. And so one of our tactics that particular day was to come on to the construction site at noon, when they'd gather all the scrapers and cats and whatnot in a circle like a wagon train at noon, and they'd all sit and eat their lunch, and they would drive the fuel tank in between them, and then they'd fill them up and then go back to work. Well, a lot of us, mostly farmers, very few outside agitators like myself, mostly farmers and their wives and their children, we all came on to the grounds, and we made a big circle around the machinery, and we joined hands and sang songs and kept walking around it. And when the time came to go back to work, we were ordered to disperse, and we wouldn't disperse. And to make a long story short, for most of these farmers, with most of them, I had very little in common politically. And we were united on this one very important issue. It was obviously it was much more important to them than to me, but it was important to me as well. And we came together, and for that, ultimately we lost. The freeway was built. But for that brief moment in time, people began to get a little seed of what they might be able to do. These were people who had never in their lives questioned authority, perhaps. And all of a sudden, their land was being assaulted, land that had been in the family for several generations in some cases. And it was just too much for them to bear. And it was a real moving experience for me. I mean, being one of the kind of the leaders of that day, I knew I would be arrested eventually that day, and I was. And the farmers rallied around me, wouldn't let the cops take me to the car, but nonetheless, the next day I went home and went back to work, and the next day, the farmers themselves were the ones arrested. It was like there was something planted there, and there was that little kind of flame of synergistic power that perhaps now is just kind of a smoldering memory of an ember in their minds, but it proved to me that people can come together and do the right thing. And for that 2 days, or for a few hours, we stopped that machine. We stopped that freeway. It was like we were talking yesterday at the end about stopping the white train, even for a minute. It's what it accomplishes is greater than the sum of the parts, I think.
And people can say, well, that's just symbolic, or that's just a symbol. And yet, symbolic things have an incredible power of their own. And I mean, that's what we look to in our past, our mythologies, the symbol of the cross, symbols of Gandhi or Martin Luther King or somebody who, apart from the details of the historical events, they become symbolic and they become very inspiring. And those symbolic experiences in our past, especially the ones that we've been involved in and participated in, can really have a transforming effect in our lives. And you just don't know how that power then feeds into some other place, some other time, and some other network to produce change.
I think there's a danger, too, though, that the symbolic gesture becomes the end in itself, the sense of having accomplished something that wasn't that, wasn't that great, and living on the experience instead of, it almost becomes the reason for doing it is the experience.
We felt power.
That's right.
Did you change anything? No, we felt power.
Local community activists were the fighting city hall is the end in itself. I think there needs to be some disappointment at winning.
Now we have power. Oh no!
Somebody's going to challenge us.
I think that's a real good. That's a real good point too, because that historically that's happened, on a pretty regular basis.
Today we talk about power as the ability to affect change. Is that a good?
I think that's fair. Yeah.
There's an argument to come about, and it has to be what it should be. And model it starts at the top. Starts at the bottom. Mm-hmm.
Gary, you mentioned Buckminster. Oh, were you finished?
No.
You mentioned Buckminster Fuller. Now, he seems to have looked at that power from the top and power from the bottom. At least at the latter part of his life, he decided the governments weren't going to get the job done. Politics, people together in governments probably weren't going to get the job done. So he talked about the real force in the world for good, and I assume standing against the proliferation of nuclear weapons is the sum total of the
personal integrity of each individual. That's what he was counting on.
And I want to say that's magnified. Not only is that that sum total of that personal integrity, so we want to certainly amplify that, but that's self-reinforcing, that each of us reinforces the other as we grow in that process of developing that integrity. That there's a synergy of bootstrapping that lifts that thing up. And I really believe in that.
What's encouraging about that is that another one of his premises, clear back in 1927, I recall, was that he was going to be involved in those things that did the most good for most of humanity. And another qualification was that he would be involved on the basis of doing things for which he did not need to get permission from anyone. And that, you know, is kind of helpful in all of this power at the top, power at the bottom. And I think it's both and. I think there's real power at the top, there's real power at the bottom. It's both and other things. And there's this individual thing where you don't need permission from anyone to get involved in certain good causes.
I think the other thing that's been helpful when you're talking about power is to contrast the coercive power, which is the power to try to, you know, force somebody to do something, with persuasive power, which, you know, is an interest to persuade somebody to do something, and or to it's a little more subtle kind of a process. When you think about the contrast between those two, just in raising your kids, if you can, I mean, there's not a whole lot you can coerce your kids into doing, but you can persuade them sometimes into doing fantastic things. Just as a mundane kind of an example, you know, it's a lot easier on you and them.
Yeah, inspire is a nice, it's even a sort of a stronger, higher concept than persuade. It suggests the setting the example, and it suggests the cooperation that's involved. That's nice. Her next...
suggests that go beyond you.
Right, that's right, and that's exactly what I'm going to get into next. That's natural lead-in, is the working of power by affecting growth in other people, rather than by seeing the power of other people as a threat to your power. See it as a way that you can nurture the system, the whole system. That they're, especially if they're working on the same side as you, or maybe only if they're working, if they're working toward health, then their power is something to be celebrated and helped out.
I think you're talking about the allied forces, huh?
Yeah, I suppose. That's one model. When we open our awareness to the web of life, we connect not only with the sufferings of others, but to the same measure with their gifts and their powers. We experience the synergy. Conditioned by the patriarchal zero-sum notion of power, we are often tempted to view the skills and good fortunes of others in a competitive fashion, to view them with envy, to take them as indications of our own inadequacy or deprivation. And I do that all the time. I mean, I just see a person who's a good teacher or a good speaker or something. I think, oh, God, I wish I could do that. Oh, gee. I was watching this tape of, Petra Kelly last week, and just thinking again about, oh, my gosh, how articulate she is and how clear her vision is and how clear it can come across. And it just really... you know, you start getting feelings of envy rather than feelings of celebration in the fact that that person is with you, and their power is in some sense your power. As synergistic open systems, as fellow neurons in the net, we can welcome these other people as a common resource. We can learn to tap them like so much money in the bank. In the Buddhist tradition, this is known as mudita, or joy in the joy of others. It is the flip side of compassion. If we can grieve with the griefs of others, so by the same token, by the same openness, we can find strength in their strengths, bolstering our own individual supplies of courage, commitment, and endurance. There are meditative practices for cultivating mudita, and I share some of these in my workshops, she does later in the book. But then, how can you join in that? Rather than just celebrating the power of others, can you empower others? And that's the next little section I want to read, and then I'll open things up again a little bit. How does power as process, synergic power, power with rather than power over, operate in our lives? We don't own it. We don't use it like a gun. We can't measure its quantity or its size. We can't increase it at our neighbor's expense. It is like a verb. It happens through us. We experience it when we engage in interactions that produce value. We can experience that with loved ones and fellow citizens, with God, with music, with art and literature, with seeds that we plant, with materials that we shape. Such synergistic exchanges generate something that was not there before and that enhances the capacities and well-being of all who are involved. This product could be a meal, a new point of view. It happens every time at Holden, right? The synergic miracle of the meals that get put on the table. Any cooks here? Thank you all. A new point of view. I felt already my delight in the growth process I've experienced here at Holden in coming together with other people and just hearing, you know, the contributions in sessions like this, or talking with other of the faculty like Scott or somebody that or Janice, and just recognizing that, golly, look at how this fits together and look how it all adds to me, builds me. In the field of potatoes, in a group consensus, in a symphony, or in a new appreciation of a symphony. In each case, it involves attentive openness to the surrounding physical or mental environment. I can't come here and just say, okay, I've got all this stuff I want to teach you folks, and here it is. And I, you know, set up the wall and I deliver. If there's not openness, if I'm not open and don't hear as well as speak, then I'm no teacher. I have no right being here. Alertness to our own and to others' responses. It is the capacity to act, and to act in ways that increase the sum total of conscious participation in life. You can know this power most intimately, perhaps, in your relationship to a lover, or a spouse, or a child. When you behold them developing their strengths and their skills, and you see them dare to take joy and risks in life, your sense of well-being is the greater. You know at that point that power consists of enhancing the power of others. It does not originate in you, but you have helped it happen, and so you have let it unfold, and it may not have happened without you. You are its midwife, its gardener. The idea of being a midwife of power is kind of a new thought for me. You have no power. You don't ever possess the power, but you enable it. You somehow provide a route for it, or you know, you bring it forth out of other people if you can. That's an exciting role to have. And once in a while, a teacher might get that gratification when you see a student of yours or something write an outstanding paper. I had a student last year was involved in the white train incident, and it was scary for me because I was feeling like, you know, don't do what I say. but there was a real excitement that came from seeing the discovery that person had in themselves. And having been just a part of that, I mean, it wasn't just me that did that. There was a number of people that could be involved in that process. We recognize this power by the extent to which it promotes conscious participation in life. To deprive someone of their rights and to put them in a detention cell is, from this perspective, an exercise of force, not power. So if this top-down thing, you know, does coercive acts, that's not power. when you take away power from people, unemployment is a disempowering. The power to fire someone, that's not power, that's a force. And it diminishes the vitality, not just of that person, but of the larger system of which we are all a part, which is deprived now of their participation and their resources. The exercise of power as process demands, therefore, that we unmask and reject all exercises of force that obstruct our and others' participation in life. That's a nice interpretation of the nonviolent ethic, I think. One that promotes the participation of others in that life, health, force, and does not deny their access to that.
By definition, though, there are legitimate powers and forces.
Sure. And the top-down stuff works real good sometimes. That's right.
Well, not only works, but I mean that there's circumstances where that is legitimate.
That's the question. Does it work?
Huh?
That's the question. How legitimate is it? And if you were saying before that both are kind of real.
No, they're real.
And in a sense, it's if the bottom gives permission to the top, you have in a way legitimated that power. And you've gotten some of both of it working for a genuine shared goal. That's a
both have a right.
That makes a lot of difference. From just when it becomes pure imposition of force is when the top exercises the possibilities of coercion without genuine permission from those being coerced.
Could I ask the group something?
Yeah.
Can I make a request to the group? Can we bring this back to a little more I statements? I think we're getting to get a little theoretical. And I think the topic of this forum or this session was personal empowerment.
That's a perfect transition to my next topic. Exactly, because
I feel like I'm getting a little blurry here. With I've shared something, and I'd like to hear from some other people. My preferences for I experiences or I feelings, the theories in the book, the theories in a lot of books.
I'm going to make one more theory statement, but it's going to be it's dealing with I stuff, very very intimately. It's very, once you've grasped onto some notion of, okay, there's power and synergy and we'll all get together and we'll have power, that's fine. And I think it's crucial, and that's why I've spent all this time on it, because I think it's a way of seeing power that's different from the way we normally think of it. But it can also be, for some people, disabling, because there's not enough appreciation in that, or they feel there's not enough, the threat or the charge is always made against it, but that doesn't respect the individual, that doesn't honor the individual, that doesn't realize the crucial role of each individual. And yet, Joanna Macy would claim it does, and I would claim it does as well, that without the individual in that network, the network doesn't work the same. It's the resources of each individual is important, first of all. But secondly, there's a crucial thing, again, in systems theory, from which she draws a lot of her stuff, and I think you could probably see this in examples in your own life, where organic systems, biologic, open, interactive systems, like she's talking about, one of the properties of them that the biologists especially have studied a lot, and physicists and chemists some too, is called threshold effects. There are certain, they don't just behave in linear fashion. They don't, as you add more and more of some force or some effect, some causal agent, some stimulus, you don't just get a linear response. It doesn't just go, you know, twice as much doesn't give twice as much effect. They have very strange effects sometimes where things will just take off like in some exponential way, some real fast-growing curve. They'll have things where things will be stable for a long time, and then they'll jump up to another state, and then they'll be stable there and jump down to another state. They'll have little effects like snow crystals forming or something, where it's water starts out as to be sort of a homogeneous stuff, And then all of a sudden as the crystal forms, a particular crystal starts, a little seed, and that seed spreads out, and all of a sudden you've got a symmetry and an order, a pattern, just because there was a phase change, a 1 degree temperature change. A little bitty change. You can change from 100 degrees down to zero, nothing happens, the water's water. And all of a sudden that 1 degree temperature change and you get these crystals forming. It's really extraordinary in interactive systems, when you've got these forces of interaction being strong and recognized. Well, the trick is to try to work with that, to look in the systems around you that you're part of and see where those little sort of points of vulnerability are, or points of possibility of quick change, points of sort of stress points, or kind of just crucial focus points, either for positive or for negative. I mean, if you're trying to bring something down, you can look for those points and bring it down. That's the trick of guerrilla warfare, I guess. Look for the vulnerabilities in the system and hit them. if you're working positively, look for those points that are self-amplifying within the system. And when you get those amplifications taking place, when the system is primed to amplify the effect of some small disturbance, you get what's called morphogenic behavior. Morpho, morphos, form, genic, like genesis, birth, form birth. You get a birth of form, and that emerges from a very small perturbation or disturbance of the system, usually. The system gets primed, and then all it takes is a seed, and all of a sudden things take off. And that seed is very often an individual, a particular individual who sees a particular role, a particular place at a certain time, and acquires incredible power, not because they are all that charismatic or they have so much power necessarily, but because they're seeing to be in the right place at the right time. And they're basically a channel for the power of others that are waiting for that seed, that catalyst, that crystal.
Gary, mm-hmm. I have a question for you. What, in regards to what we've been talking about, coercion, persuasion, or real power, what was it in the case of Jesus Christ that led him to the crucifixion, the whole dynamics of that transaction? Was that real power, or was it coercion on the part of the people, or?
Well, do you mind if I pass on that one? In 5 minutes, I really don't want to try to address that. Where does the power of Jesus Christ come from? What is the source of Christ's power? I think is what I hear you asking, and I think that comes from at oneness with all the powers, with God, with the Father, with the Mother, with the powers of the earth, with knowing himself, with knowing the people around him, his understanding of the situation that he was in, his incredible openness. I mean, I see Jesus as an amazingly open person, and he allowed the forces that were there to work their power on him. Yeah. I think he did set himself up in a sense. I mean, I don't think he desired crucifixion. I think that's clear in his prayers in Gethsemane, but he didn't stand up on his throne and say, "I've had it. This is enough. I will not do this." And so I think there was a sense in which I guess I have to believe that in that sacrifice that he made, that was a showing of power. That it wasn't just a defeat, it was an act of power. That's what the resurrection means to me. That silly kind of power of hanging there on a cross is real power. That's the power that Christians are called to exercise.
Thank you.
That's what Job did. To suicide, that he knew the power of Jesus, and he was sure that when he pushed Jesus forward, into the crisis situation, Jesus would have to do the power in the way Jesus expected him to.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't. And Jesus was driving him batty because, because, you know, they have in front of these guys, you know, hey, speak to the Romans, defend yourself, you know, you're king of the Jews, do all this stuff. And he didn't exercise the power. I mean, you know, we believe he had the whole power of the universe, and he was driving him batty because he didn't use them in the way they expect them to.
In the last few minutes, I want to do one more thing, and that is the thing that maybe you thought I was going to do in the first place when we came to a session like this, and talk just a little bit about what kinds of resources one might have at one's disposal if you're looking for some kind of empowerment in the nuclear age. And I'm going to share, in particular, some that have been helpful for me. Some of the people Holden I know, and some staff people, but maybe some guests haven't even heard of, Order of St. Martin and Teresa. Order of Saints Martin and Teresa. It's a peace order that's just a network around the country of probably about 80% Lutherans and 20% other folks that has been, it started maybe 15 years ago and has been kind of quietly doing its stuff in the background. And right now they have a newsletter that goes out to all the participants. Basically just a sharing. Right now it's been particularly a sharing of readings from various people, but I'm sure part of the idea of that newsletter would be a sharing of points of view and of stories, stories of empowerment, stories of frustration with each other. And to me, it has just meant an awful lot to be part of a group of people out there that I know think somewhat like I do and are struggling with some of the same questions that I'm struggling with, and know that I'm not alone in that struggle. So I joined the Order of St. Martin. What joining means is to ask for the newsletter, I guess. But there's other things with Order of St. Martin, that their tradition has been to establish certain, to choose among a choice of various disciplines that they suggest for you that can be helpful in your life. And those disciplines, they kind of change over the years as different people suggest different things, but they include such things as taking a daily walk every day for 10 minutes, sort of a meditative walk, not for the sake of losing weight, although it's good for you for that regard too, me, but for the sake of reflecting on God, on your life, on how your life is working with forces for peace and how it's working against peace. That's one of the resources we have if we want to seek power, is a daily walk, something that simple. Keeping a journal of what goes on in your life, especially with regard to peace issues, either on a personal level, your family, or reflecting on events that you've read about in the newspaper, or again, frustrations you've had in your job. But a journal can very often be a cathartic way of dealing with the tensions that sometimes rise up in our lives, a diary type of thing. It doesn't have to be for anyone else's sake but your own. It doesn't have to be eloquent, but it's just another way of maybe allowing you to have power. Some people have found it to be empowering. Another resource is meditative walk journal. Oh, just learning about peace issues, moving your life along the way of peace. And the last thing, right, that I want to mention, this little paperclip that I've got on my shirt lapel is a symbol that the Order of St. Martin people have adopted. It's in St. Martin and Teresa. I'm sorry, I forgot Teresa. They just changed the title, the name, a year ago, so to include some women. Good decision. The paperclip was a symbol used by the children in World War II in occupied Norway as a symbol of basically protest and nonviolent resistance to the Germans. And they would, what can the kids do against Nazi occupation force? But one of the things they just wanted to do was to symbolize that we're not with you. One of the ways they could say we're not with you was to stick this paperclip on their shirts or on their clothes, somewhere on their clothes every day, And the Nazis kind of figured out that it was a symbol of contempt. They would tear them off and take them away. And, you know, paper clips are so ubiquitous, they could stick them back on again. And all the kids had had them. So it got to be sort of a thing that you could hardly oppose. And it's nothing really offensive, but it's a symbolic defiance that was there. And so the Order of St. Martin folk will wear a paperclip, and if you see paperclips on people around Holden or other places, you'll be able to know what that means. Yeah, it's a symbol of non-cooperation with violence, and a symbol of an ideal or a search, being part of a group searching for a more peaceful world. There's also Lutheran Peace Fellowship. The addresses for both these places I have, if you're interested in seeing me about them. Lutheran Peace Fellowship sends out a newsletter quarterly, and it's more informational. It's not meditative in by the same sense as Order of St. Martin, Saints Martin and Teresa. But it maybe has a 30, 40 year history. I think it started with supporting of the conscientious objectors in World War II, and has been affiliated with the Fellowship of Reconciliation and other nonviolent groups. So there are resources even within the Lutheran Church, which is not a peace church, for dealing with, there are peace elements within the church, and they might be helpful for you.